So tonight I'm going to speak about the happiness of the Buddha. That was what was listed on the website. I didn't actually, until this morning, I didn't discover that six months ago I had sent an email saying that I would do the retreat on the happiness of the Buddha and do the evening talk, as the evening talk would be waking up in the midst of it all. But then I found out tonight is the happiness of the Buddha. So this is the condensed version. And because I'm condensing, I'm just letting my mind just do what it does with this discourse. And while I was sitting, things started to percolate a little bit. And it was interesting what floated through my mind about the happiness of the Buddha. The first thing that came through my mind was a passage that was written on the cave, a cave on the island of Koh Phangan in Thailand. The walls of the cave, and this cave had been inhabited by an American guy who was living in the cave and was living there many years and practicing, and he got something like dengue fever or something and died. And people then discovered some of his artwork that was in the cave, and then some things he had written on the walls of the cave. And the line that someone sent me, it was a friend of mine who was at the time a monk in Burma. He had recently gone to Burma. He sent me a postcard, and at the end of the postcard he said, he quoted this fellow from Thailand, he said, "Oh, what a joy to know there is no happiness in this world. Be happy." What do you think he meant by that? Oh, what a joy to know there is no happiness in this world. You can think about that for a moment. The other line that floated through my mind, I think I was maybe feeling a little mischievous or something, but the other line was a line from a teacher named Sri Nisargadatta Maharaj. Many of you probably read Nisargadatta, his famous book called I Am That. And the line that came through my mind was, "Nothing can make you happier than you are. All search for happiness is misery and leads to more misery." He doesn't stop there. He says the only happiness worth that name is the natural happiness of conscious being. And I think both passages remind us that it is often our continual search for happiness that prevents us from seeing it, prevents us from realizing that the very happiness that we are so innocently and longingly searching for is none other than the very nature of our minds when we are here, not looking ahead and not looking back. When we're not caught in the what I like to call the trance of time, not caught in that state of suspended well-being that comes when our view of reality is that happiness is what will happen next, tomorrow, next life, after 7 retreats, after this evening maybe. But rather, it is the very nature of our mind, you could say, is the happiness of a Buddha. So that's the absolute version, is you, in some ways, you are right here and now as you are what you are looking for. If you just let yourself be immersed, just sit down in it, in life, wherever, as one of my favorite poems says, right where it touches you. And don't look ahead and don't look back. Or if you're looking ahead or looking back, know that you're here looking ahead or looking back. That if you know you're here, you're awake to what's happening, you can realize that you are what you're looking for. That there really is no higher mountain to climb than that natural happiness of conscious being. Because you'll notice, I think you'll notice, that when you don't look back and you don't look ahead, when you let yourself just be here, just for a few moments in the span of your hour here, if you just let yourself be here completely, without looking back or without looking ahead, without reflecting on your life or your situation, and if you are reflecting on your life or your situation, that you notice that. That if you're just here, that you will naturally, without having changed anything in your life, you will have stepped out of the stream of distress. You will find, as one sutra puts it very, very succinctly, a sutra called the Avatamsaka Sutra. It says, having no view of self, one is always peaceful. So in other words, how we ordinarily leave here, in our minds at least, is we leave here by entering into the imaginary world of ourselves as sufferers. The imaginary world of ourselves as someone who has gone from the past, is moving through the present on our way to the future. That one who is in that drama of trying to find happiness, that one that plays in our mind is actually imaginary. The one who we are, you could say, the one whose natural state is happiness, is right here. And when I say that, I don't mean the idea of you. I mean your direct and immediate experience. Again, if you don't look back and you don't look ahead. If you just sense for a moment what happens when there is no view of self, no view of other. What's the felt experience when you're just here? Now, I'll just give you a little sneak preview about the happiness of the Buddha. It requires that we speak somewhat historically. But he said that the highest happiness is peace. He didn't say the highest happiness is having a good mood. Because if that were the case, then we would all join that yoga society in Mumbai. Have you heard about it? It's the laughing yoga society where they do this repetitive, what they do together. We can do it. We can definitely get some, we can laugh a little. It goes, ho, 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 ha, ha, ha. Ho, 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 ha, ha, ha. Let's do it. Ho, 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 ha, ha, ha. 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 It's cool. You get happy. You get very happy. It kind of gladdens our... Look at everybody. You all look happy. And that kind of happiness, of course, could be one of the many byproducts of the happiness of a Buddha. But it's that kind of happiness isn't really the aim, because that kind of happiness is not particularly reliable. Because sometimes maybe if we kept it up for 24 hours a day, we could laugh ourselves through. But eventually, that level of laughter would fade, and there would be that gap, and then there would be that likely, just as what happens for most of us when we experience the joy of laughter, is that there's a fading of that, and there's often a little bit of sorrow in the fading of it, and then our mind doesn't just settle into that sorrow and find a sense of balance and peace with it. Our mind immediately goes back into the trance of time again. It goes in search of the next ho 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 ha 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 in whatever form that might take. So the happiness of a Buddha does not is not the happiness of a good mood, but it's a happiness of not even the mood of peace, but it's a happiness of recognizing something in us that is intrinsically, that you could call peace, but some intrinsic silence or peace or sufficiency or something that can't even be put so easily into words, but can only be realized. So that's the kind of the absolute truth. But the Buddha didn't find that that highest happiness, the happiness of freedom, the happiness of nirvana, the happiness of peace. He didn't find that through simply reminding himself, I am what I'm looking for. He had to do a whole production. That's the paradox, that freedom or peace is the end of all that searching. But only those who search seem to find it. So there's no shortcut here. And it seems from the way that practice has unfolded over the millennia that there is a, in spite of it being the ultimate truth of your nature, it seems that every human being that innocently longs to be happy has to go through some kind of a progressive path, some kind of purification, some kind of process of awakening, to be able to, with conviction and confidence, say, "I am what I'm looking for," or "I'm free," or "I'm happy," or "I'm complete," "I'm home," "I'm enough." I think most of us can do that for a moment. In fact, I invite you again to do that. I'm home. And see if there's any suffering when you just say that to yourself. If you don't look back and you don't look ahead. Notice what that's like. So all we do in those moments is we suspend our usual preoccupations. One teacher named Sri Nisargadatta, again the same one, he says, when the mind is temporarily free of its preoccupations, it becomes quiet. And if you don't disturb that quiet and you stay in it, you'll discover that it's permeated with a light and a love you've never known. Yet you recognize it at once as your own nature. Once you've tasted that, you'll never be the same person again. He says the unruly mind will break that peace and obliterate that vision, but it's bound to return, and this is where the path comes in, as long as the effort is sustained. Until all bonds are broken, something like grasping and attachment ends, and life becomes supremely concentrated in the present. So everything of the path is fulfilled by being here, the path of happiness, by being here, getting used to that sense of presence. But it seems that there are a few things that we need to do along the way. First and foremost, what the Buddha spoke about was establishing in our lives, in our unfolding present moments, because there are only unfolding present moments. There's only now, in a way. That there's no past and there's no future. There's just what's presenting itself right now. And what we experience as we sit together here is we experience as our stream of consciousness, we experience the fruits, and our whole inner and outer experience, you could say, would be the fruits of what we have practiced before, where we have dwelt. So the fact that you're here tells me that there's been some seeds planted that have allowed you to give value to being quiet, to being present, to not wanting to be so obsessed with what one of my friend calls there and then, that to be much more interested in here and now. Otherwise you wouldn't be here. So this is the fruit of past practice, or past whatever you've done with your mind. But a lot of what shows up as our present experience, our conditioning, is the result of a case of mistaken faith in things, a misplaced faith in what it is, where it is, how it is I can actually find happiness in this very life. And a case of mistaken identity with that imaginary version that plays through our minds. That's a lot of what flows through. And so the Buddha wanted us to remember first and foremost, this is the way it seems to me, that we are, one, not as independent as we think we are. That there is not any element of our mind and body that exists completely independently from all the myriad causes and conditions that have led us to this moment, to be here. That we are part of an interwoven sea of contingencies, things coming together. And all that coming together is making you, has brought you to this moment. One of my colleagues on the most recent retreat used the word that I've used a lot in my own teaching, the word, it's an expression called yata bhuta. It means things, generally it's translated as things as they are. But she brought a different translation that our friend Gil Fronsdale gave to her, which is things as they have come to be. So each of us is the fruit of, and whatever you experience this moment is the fruit of what has come to be. And a lot of what has come to be, our conditioning, is such that we have become, I would say, excessively dependent on pleasure. Any of you relate to that? And the avoidance of pain. This is completely understandable. As even the Dalai Lama says, that universally everybody wants to be happy and nobody wants to suffer. It's completely natural. However, this dependency on pleasure for our sense of well-being and the avoidance of pain has left us how things have come to be as we experience a chronic state of dissatisfaction. And a chronic state of restlessness, worry, a chronic state, for the most part, maybe this isn't true for you, but a chronic sense of I can't be happy now. And some condition has to change in order for me to find relief, in order to be at peace. And so consequently, we find ourselves with this chronic sense of hanging in suspended happiness, with our sense of well-being being all about what's next. I call it the obsession with what's next. The The way the Buddha talked about it is that we are caught in what he called Lokiya Sukha. Lokiya Sukha is happiness or comfort or pleasure. It's bouncing around a little bit. Not too much. Lokiya means worldly. Lokiya means of the world. Lokiya Sukha. So it's worldly happiness. But it has a more subtle meaning. Worldly happiness, Lokiya Sukha, means happiness that depends on satisfying some kind of hunger. So it's called dependent happiness. It's also been translated by Ajahn Buddhadasa, I think, as the happiness of bondage, the happiness of slavery. It's that sense of suspended happiness. I'm happy if I have it. I'm unhappy, holding out, waiting if I don't have it. It's often tethered to, in our daily lives, it's tethered to the end of the day, the weekend, to the vacation, to the big purchase, to the end of our life. Some little trance that has the effect of us overlooking or postponing our sense of freedom now. Our discovery of what he called the other kind of happiness. He called it Lokuttara Sukha. Lokuttara means unstuck from worldly happiness. Beyond the power and influence of whatever's happening. A well-being that is free, independent of circumstances. A well-being that is not, that is free of hunger. That sense of not wanting anything. For some reason, Nisargadatta is showing up a lot tonight. He put it this way. As long as we believe that we need things to make us happy, we shall also believe that in their absence we must be miserable. Mind shapes itself according to its beliefs. Pleasure is a distraction, he says. For it merely increases the false conviction that one needs to have and do things to be happy, when in reality it's just the opposite. Real happiness is best expressed negatively as, there's nothing wrong with me. I have nothing to worry about. After all, the ultimate purpose of practice is to reach a point where this conviction, instead of being only verbal, is based on actual, ever-present experience. Which experience, a questioner asks? The experience of being empty, uncluttered by memories and expectations. It is like the happiness of open spaces, of being young, of having all the time and energy for doing things, for discovery, for adventure. Your true home is in this openness or emptiness. Emptiness of all content. True happiness has no cause, and what has no cause is immovable. So this Lokuttara Sukha is this happiness that has no cause, the unconditioned, the unborn, sometimes called the deathless. So where does that leave us? Well, one of the issues is that there's a tendency in meditation practice, when people come to practice, to say they really want, they're interested in this Lokutra Sukha, this well-being that doesn't depend on conditions. But in fact, secretly, unknowingly, we're just looking for more refined pleasure. Any of you relate to that? As one teacher calls it, high-class samsara. That's Sokhne Rinpoche. So the Buddha's point was that at least one of his points is if you truly aimed in your heart of hearts for that well-being that didn't depend on whether it's noisy outside, whether the sirens are going or whether they're not, if you're aiming for that the happiness of freedom, that all the other kinds of pleasure and happiness will come in its wake. But if you are under the misplaced faith that those other experiences will make you truly happy, you will spin, as most of us do in some way. You will spin in the samsaric loop, endlessly waiting for a future that never arrives, because we discover in our practice that time is always now, that there really is no future, it doesn't exist, no such thing as tomorrow. It's one of the things we realize when we stop for a moment, that there's only this unfolding present. The other thing that we realize when we sit here is that case of mistaken identity, because our sense of well-being has been so much of the in so much of our evolution, even our brain development, so much of our well-being has been tethered to satisfying hunger. It has left our whole sense of identity in a state of insecurity. And the more I depend on what's next, the more insecure I become. And the more I fall into the view of myself as less than or insufficient, not enough. Any of you ever have that? You ever compare yourself negatively to anyone else? Okay, I just wondered if it was just me or not. And because of our insecurity, because of that feeling of insecurity that comes from looking for a sense of security in the wrong place, that increases the more we try to escape its traps. And of course, our culture is completely built on this. As Sogyal Rinpoche put it, this is why our insecurity is so understandable from a cultural vantage point. He says, sometimes that I think the greatest achievement of modern culture is its brilliant selling of samsara and its barren distractions. Modern society seems to me to be a celebration of all the things that lead away from the truth, make truth hard to live for, and discourage people from even believing that it exists. And to think that all this springs from a civilization that claims to adore life, but actually starves it of any real meaning, that endlessly speaks of making people happy, but in fact blocks their way to the source of real joy. This modern samsara feeds off an anxiety and depression that it fosters and trains us all in and carefully nurtures with a consumer machine that needs to keep us greedy to keep going. Samsara is highly organized, versatile, and sophisticated. It assaults us from every angle with its propaganda and creates an almost impregnable environment of addiction around us. The more we try to escape, the more we seem to fall into the traps that it is so ingenious at setting for us. As one Lama said, mesmerized by the sheer variety of perceptions, beings wander endlessly astray in samsara's vicious cycle. obsessed then with false hopes, dreams, and ambitions which promise happiness but lead only to misery. We are like people crawling through an endless desert, dying of thirst. And all that samsara holds out to us to drink is a cup of salt water designed to make us even thirstier. Because of that insecurity, we have gotten very, very tight and defended, and consequently caused ourselves harm. We've caused ourselves harm, and we've blamed everyone and everything for that insecurity, for that vulnerability. The invitation of practice, we'll talk more about it on the weekend, is to embrace that vulnerability, embrace the fragility, use the very effect of everything that's happened in our lives, use it all to bring us back to this vital point of here and now, to let everything, every aspect of our mind, whether it's empty, that perfect emptiness, or full of misery, we use it all as our reminder of our love of being just who we are, right where we are, right where life is touching us. That's for later on. For now, we can appreciate that we've made a mess of our life and our world, innocently out of our insecurities and our defenses. And so the Buddha started by saying, if you really want to be able to enjoy this world of pleasure and not make it your devotion, not be so addicted to it, but enjoy it, it is your birthright to be able to enjoy the senses. This world was not made so beautiful and so intoxicating to the senses just for you to see how defiled they are, how much suffering there is. 5 out of our 6 senses are our physical senses, that where we can take and enjoy things. There's that the enjoyment of things, that's not the problem. It's the fixation of our mind. It's the tightening around, as the Buddha called it, the misplaced faith in the pleasure of the senses for our well-being that adds to our misery. So he said, if you really want to enjoy this world and you have to have some understanding, first of all, of what the limitations are of this world of sense pleasures. If they're fleeting, they're unreliable, and they leave in their wake more desire for them. So you need to know the enjoyment of them, you need to know their danger, and you need to know what it's like to be free of them, to be free with them. But if you really want to enjoy them, this is the ingredients for a kind of happiness. And that the ingredients are to be a good person, to establish your life in the bliss or the joy of non-harming, of not causing harm in your thoughts, in your words, in your actions, taking appreciating as much as you can every day that you are in this interdependent, this interbeing relationship with all beings, and that every action that you do, everything that comes out of your mouth, everything you think, and everything you do has an impact. You've all heard this before. This is Dharma 101. Our actions have consequences. And whatever we say to ourselves or others, we cause harm to ourselves, we cause harm to others. We cause harm to others, we cause harm to ourselves. We're very sensitive beings. And that a kind of worldly happiness depends on being able to even enjoy the senses. It depends on our mind being somewhat free of the effects of our actions. In other words, if I'm constantly causing harm with my thoughts or my speech or my actions, those things will reverberate in my mind and my life. I will be disturbed. You notice what it's like when you say one thing where you know that it may have been true, but it wasn't so useful, wasn't so timely, and it wasn't necessarily for the person's benefit. It was to jab them or something. You know there's a huge reverberation for that kind of action. And it can ripple in your consciousness. It's virtually impossible to really enjoy yourself when you're feeling the effects of some of the things that we do, think, and say. So to establish this pattern or path of non-harming is a central ingredient. It's the foundation for the other kinds of happiness that can come the more we're here. The Buddha basically said that there are four kinds of worldly happiness that we can have. The happiness of having resources and enjoying the senses, the happiness of sharing those resources and sense experiences, sharing with others, the happiness of being debt-free. How many of you know that one? It's not very common in this world. And then the fourth one was the happiness of blamelessness, of that mind that's not reverberating from the effects of actions. And of those four, that the happiness of blamelessness is 16 times more powerful or more stronger, more important than the other three. And ultimately, this is the foundation for what makes it possible for us to know what it's like, as I shared that passage before from Nisargadatta, to know what it's like to have a mind momentarily free of its preoccupations, to discover what the Buddha discovered in his own practice, the more refined kind of pleasure, the happiness of a mind that is well collected, composed, and concentrated. Mind where there is a calm abiding. There is what he called a quality of unmixed well-being, unmixed happiness. When he says unmixed happiness, it means that your mind is temporarily free of wanting to be somewhere else, not wanting what you're having, free of restlessness and worry, free of doubt, and free of dullness, the stupor. That a mind that is well collected is exceedingly pleasurable. If you don't have that first foundation, it's really not possible to train our attention to stay here. And if you can train your attention to stay here, as the Buddha did, you will. And many of you, I think probably a lot of people in here are old yogis. You know, you've tasted those periods where you could call it, as he called it, purity of mind, where your mind isn't inundated with any hindrances for a while. And it's very sweet and very inspiring. And it tends to, when we experience that, it tends to decondition, tends to loosen our tendency to chase after anything that gets in the way of that calm. So our life starts being a little bit more oriented toward things that keep supporting that calm abiding, that peaceful present, that and mostly that feeds into more non-harming and less compulsion and ultimately more calm abiding. But the Buddha realized, as you probably all know from the story, was looking for a quote that would express what he realized. I have one here. There it is. This passage called the... This is from Hafiz, called the 10,000 Idiots. It is always a danger This is what the Buddha realized. It is always a danger to aspirants on the path when they begin to believe and act as if the 10,000 idiots who so long ruled and lived inside have all packed their bags and skipped town or died. Want me to read it again? It's always a danger to aspirants on the path when they begin to believe and act as if the 10,000 idiots who so long ruled and lived inside have all packed their bags and skipped town or died. You realize that even that most beautiful and inspiring and onward leading happiness of a concentrated heart and mind, that's well composed, that even that was another more rarefied form of the unreliable world of sense pleasures, subsumed under the umbrella of what is often described as dukkha, unsatisfactory, unreliable. That kind of dukkha, that kind of sukha, that comfort, that the comfort of happiness and is actually dukkha, sometimes called sukha dukkha. So this is a reminder that the happiness of the Buddha does not depend on a state, that all states are impermanent and unreliable. So it does not depend on getting to some place of quiet. Many people, when they come to practice, it's all about quieting the mind. And that's really not the point. It is not the point. In fact, and this will be probably a little bit more of the theme of the weekend, it really doesn't matter what's in your mind for the purpose of awakening. Everything gets used. Everything simply is used to increase that confidence and faith, not so much in whatever it is that's in our mind, but faith in the awareness that knows it. Faith in that capacity to meet that experience with less and less reactivity and dependency. And this is where the happiness of the Buddha evolved next, as you know. The Buddha gave up looking for special states and instead sat under the Bodhi tree and started paying attention, which is doing the practice that most of you have been training in, vipassana or mindful attention, loving kindness, bringing kind, loving attention to the flow of experience, however it's presenting itself. And when he sat under the Bodhi tree, as you sit under your Bodhi tree, each time you sit, you are met with a whole array of experience, the fruits of everything you've practiced before, experienced before. And those experiences, if you use them all, they, rather than the... See, for awareness, awareness is neither enhanced by your pleasant experiences, nor is it diminished by the unpleasant ones. It actually just, it doesn't care. And the more you notice things, the brighter your mind gets. It's like rubbing two sticks together. The rubbing of attention on anything brightens the mind. And you will know for yourself if you do that in a kind of relentless way, in a continuous way, in your life, in this very life, in whatever you're doing, when you're doing it, and you're mindful of it, you will become, as Ajahn Chah says, brighter and brighter in any surrounding. You will become clear, like a clear forest pool. And you'll see many wonderful and strange animals come to drink at the pool, but you'll be still. This is the happiness of a Buddha. So it's a little sneak preview. So what we see as our mind gets brighter and brighter is we see the common, just as the Buddha did, we see that what we start to see the commonality in every animal that comes to drink in the pool. we start to see that every experience, no matter how high and mighty, how basic, every experience is marked by changeability, by impermanence. Every experience, it becomes one that we see cannot be considered a reliable refuge. And every experience is experienced and understood as being unbidden, selfless, happening, just happening. But the effect of that is this great joy of a mind that is no longer confused, no longer looking for happiness in all the wrong places, mind that has relinquished its stickiness. That's the function of awareness, to release the stickiness that our experience brings to us, where we get so bound up and so identified with what's happening. When that stickiness loosens, we find our home, wherever we are, in whatever condition. And as we find our home, right where life is touching us, that home in us as us, our mind relaxes and we realize the with a little gremlin or we realize the highest happiness, the happiness of freedom. This is the happiness of the Buddha. So as I would like to end these few stray thoughts with one of my favorite poems on happiness from Gendun Rinpoche. It's called Free and Easy. Happiness cannot be found through great effort and willpower, but is already present in open relaxation and letting go. Don't strain yourself. There's nothing to do or to undo. Whatever momentarily arises in your body and mind has no real importance at all and has little reality whatsoever. Why identify with and become so attached to it, passing judgment upon it and ourselves? Far better to simply let the entire game happen on its own, springing up and falling back like waves, without changing and manipulating anything. And notice how everything vanishes and reappears, magically, again and again, time without end. Only our searching for happiness prevents us from seeing it. It's like a vivid rainbow, which you pursue without ever catching, or a dog chasing its own tail. Although peace and happiness do not exist as an actual thing or place, it is always available and accompanies you every instant. Don't believe in the reality of good and bad experiences. They are like today's ephemeral weather, like rainbows in the sky. Wanting to grasp the ungraspable, you exhaust yourself in vain. As soon as you open and relax this tight fist of grasping, infinite space is there, open, inviting, comfortable. Make use of this spaciousness, this freedom and natural ease. Don't search any further. Don't go into the tangled jungle looking for the great awakened elephant who is already resting quietly at home in front of your own hearth. Nothing to do or to undo, nothing to force, nothing to want, and nothing missing. Marvelous. Everything unfolds by itself. So let's just sit quietly for a few moments.